It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the achievement gap in Wisconsin schools and what we might be able to do about it.
First, love it or hate it, it's hard to deny the cultural impact professional wrestling has had on America.
And our next guest says if you look past the spandex and the body slams, there's true art form there. And he's written an investigative account that details the history and culture of the sport and its many passionate fans.
Joining us now is David Shoemaker. He's a contributor to Grantland and Deadspin. His new book is The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So wrestling has been around. Humans have been doing it for a long time. But when did professional wrestling, as we know it in the United States today, really get started?
Well, I mean, around 1900, it started in carnival sideshows all over the country. It was just an exhibit like so many others. By the 20s, it was pretty much it was an established national sport, and by the end of the 20s, it was institutionalized as, you know, the kind of fake sport that we know today, even though people weren't really clued into that for some time.
So, and this is something you talk about in your book. People talk about, we're just figuring out that this is fake or something like that. There's been talk about that going back at least to the 20s, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was kind of a surprise to me. People always talk about Vince McMahon dragging, wrestling, kind of kicking and screaming into the sunlight in the mid-80s when he decided to start calling it sports entertainment. But not only were there numerous accounts I found of people talking about it being fake dating back to the 20s, like you said, but Vince McMahon's own dad was a wrestling promoter, and he was basically admitting that it was fake to Washington papers in the 50s.
And how did that come about? I get the gist that there was real, thriving, honest wrestling going on, but when people are doing it properly, it doesn't look as theatrical or exciting from the back rows.
Yeah, it's funny because I was writing about wrestling for a long time and compared it to kind of like ancient Greek theater a lot, because they work in such broad strokes with the characters that it's kind of like the old masks. You know, you're always playing to the person in the back row. But originally, wrestling was incredibly boring to watch to anybody that wasn't in the front row. I mean, it was just guys hugging each other on the mat for hours and hours and hours at a time. And it changed to the sort of pseudo sport that it is today, just out of, sheer functionality. The matches are more desirable when the guys were yelling at each other and had feuds. And the matches themselves were more interesting to watch when people started, jumping off the ground and tackling each other. And the guys behind the wrestling industry were smart enough to realize that.
Now, it's one thing to say it's staged or it's fake, but they're really doing some amazing athletic stuff there, aren't they?
Yeah, and doing amazing damage to themselves in the process.
So how about the rise of TV? How did that affect wrestling from being a carnival sideshow to being really a mass entertainment cultural form?
Well, I mean, there have been a lot of cycles of massive popularity in wrestling, and they often coincide with the emergences of new media. When national television first started in the 50s, wrestling was quickly grabbed onto by the Dumont Network that was just looking for content, basically, and there had been local wrestling shows all over the country that were really easy to turn into national shows. And you can imagine in those days, wrestling was much easier to film and to present than any other sport would have been. So at that point in time, the wrestling was huge. Guys like Gorgeous George were national celebrities. I mean, and were paid commensurately. And the same thing happened again in the 80s when USA Network and the TBS, those kind of the first cable networks went live, and they needed content again. And wrestling was right there to fill up their time slots.
And when it first went national, you describe the situation before that where we had world champions in Minnesota and world champions in New York, a whole bunch of world champions who never would have encountered each other. How did it start consolidating into first two or three national organizations and then just, WWE being the dominant force?
Well, I mean, it was basically cable television that did the trick. I mean, for the NWA, which was sort of the national governing body of wrestling, all of these separate territories, and there were as few as 30 and as many as 60 over the span of the years, they operated independently, and they had, they shared champions and they shared talent and stuff like that. But if you lived in, if you lived in Waxahachie, you could just go on pretending that or believing that your wrestling show was all that mattered in the world. Once, you know, NWA shows got on TBS, it became really clear to everyone that there was a bigger world out there. And then when Vince McMahon took over the WWF, and he decided, you know, very deliberately that he was going to run a national promotion. And so he started touring the country into other people's territories. He started, you know, hiring up talent at a breakneck pace, and you know, just about took over the wrestling world. And I mean, you know, years later, he functionally would.
And there was some cutthroat business there. You said he was hiring the top talent from other people, and you give stories of him doing some creative counter programming to spike the competition. Can you talk about that?
Oh yeah, I mean Vince is a visionary, but he's nothing if not a, you know, a cutthroat businessman. You know, he had the first WrestleMania, and when the NWA promotion saw the money that could be made and the success that could be had running these like giant pay-per-view events, these singular events, they tried to do the same thing. And whenever they would do it, Vince would just counter-program with another big show of his own and go to the cable companies and say, you know, if you run their show, you don't get WrestleMania next year. Stuff like that would happen all the time. And throughout the book, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I write about the backstage dealings, the real life dealings. And you see over and over again that it's kind of just as brutal and crazy as the stuff that happens in the ring.
Let's talk about that. I mean, the ring is, for the most part, simulated violence, and they play with rivalries. That's been going on since the dawn of modern professional wrestling. But is there really bad blood behind the scenes?
I mean, there's always guys who don't like each other, but you know, once you get into the ring, about 99.9% of the time, you put that aside because you're holding, you know, your partner's life in your hands, more or less. The way that these matches are set up, I'm sure a lot of people know, is that the outcomes are predetermined. They're vaguely scripted, depending on the wrestler. Usually, they're mostly improvised in the ring. And you know, the punches, the falls, all that kind of stuff is planned on the fly, but it still hurts really badly. So, you know, if you drop a guy the wrong way, you could end his career. You could, you know, do terrible damage to him. But in a bigger picture, you know, between different promotions, there were always huge rivalries. And guys like, you know, like Vince McMahon and the other sort of P.T. Barnums of his age, would have done just about anything to get rid of the other guy.
Well, that's interesting. I always kind of assumed that it was really choreographed. How the heck do you improvise something that has such a small margin of error for somebody getting really hurt?
Well, I mean, there are different phrases that you'll hear wrestlers use in interviews, but they basically just have it down to a really quick, really insidery patter. You know, it's one of the skills you have to learn to do it. I mean, it really is incredible. And it's one of those things where, you know, people argue against wrestling being a sport. I mean, it's not a sport, but I mean, in the sense that, you know, the outcomes are obviously predetermined, but man, these guys are talented and they're not just talented stuntmen. I mean, they're in there, you know, speaking a language that no one else knows and figuring out how to just do these incredible acrobatic tricks on the fly, in a way that, you know, LeBron James probably couldn't do it.
And you talk about how the wrestlers have become more than wrestlers. They become these massive personalities. How did that happen? How did they become such pop culture figures?
Well, I mean, like I said, there are guys like Gorgeous George going way back who were the biggest stars in the world. And you know, so many people in all walks of entertainment, I should say, were influenced by them. But I think it's just something really particular to the wrestling world. You know, we have superstars in all kind of sports and entertainment like that. But you know, pro wrestlers are playing the role of gods, more or less. You know, they're real life superheroes. And you know, at the moments of the greatest kind of pop cultural crossover, someone like Hulk Hogan really represents something more than, you know, Michael Jordan. He's a living, breathing, mythological figure, and somehow that really just kind of taps into, you know, our human history and into the zeitgeist at the same time.
Let's give a listen to Hulk Hogan. We pulled just a couple clips from the heyday of wrestling.
All right.
And to beat me, man, you've got to beat every Hulkamaniac, every little Hulkster in the world, everyone that plays it straight, all the ones that don't take any shortcuts, brother. And they usually say, if the dirty air don't get you, the politicians will. But in this case, it's going to be Hulkamania.
And that was back when I watched wrestling, back in the Hulkamania era. And he just, I mean, these guys are actors too, the best ones, the ones that became stars, and that amazing like cadence and the out of breath quality that he delivered. These guys are actors in some ways as much as athletes.
Yeah, it's really funny if you go back and you watch a whole, you know, so much of wrestling like I have, especially when I was writing the book, you realize that the acting style is sort of like it's a borrowed style. I mean, it's something that they all sort of worked together on over the years. Like Hogan was supremely influenced by guys like Superstar Billy Graham and Dusty Rhodes. He took the parts of their shtick that he thought would work for his shtick, and he kind of makes it into this, you know, a style all of his own. But yeah, I mean, it's incredible, and you said it exactly right. Not everyone who wrestles can act, but the guys who become stars, especially post, you know, 1980, their acting is basically the most important thing that they do.
We're talking with David Shoemaker about his new book, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. We want to hear from you. Do you watch pro wrestling, or did you at some point in the past? What about it did you love, or what don't you like? Did you have a favorite wrestling hero or villain? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take your calls right after the break. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. We continue our conversation now with David Shoemaker. His new book is The Squared Circle, Life, Death, and Professional Wrestling. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're a fan, if you were a fan, or if you have a question. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to Eric in Toma. Eric, you're on the line.
Yeah, great show. I was just curious, was kind of wondering about the scripting for the characters. I was wondering if they had a lot to do with their scripting, if the writers actually controlled most of what the script said, and the overall the theme that the characters are going for, their overall, I don't know, I guess you'd call it their character profile, if that's all scripted in or if that's something that each individual superstar comes up with.
Gotcha. Thanks for the question, Eric.
Well, I mean, there's two different things. The characters are, you know, are usually a process that gets put together in conjunction with the promoters and the wrestlers. As far as the script itself goes, back before, you know, in the territorial days and before, all of that stuff was, you know, totally come up with on the fly. They would go out with a couple of bullet points, you know, don't forget to say you want to beat up Dusty Rhodes, and then the guys would just talk for 10 minutes basically off the cuff. I mean, it's a real skill.
And it sounded like it.
And then, you know, as time goes on, there's more, you know, they're given more bullet points. They have more things to do. Those Hulk Hogan promos, like the one you played before, they would sometimes just go in a studio and record 50 of those in a row, you know, like tailored for every market that they're going to be touring to. The way it is now, basically every episode of you know, Monday Night Raw or whatever show has a completely written script. I mean, it's like a Hollywood script for every episode, but, you know, it's still based in the same history. So wrestlers are often, I mean, are basically free to just, you know, go off the cuff. Also, it's live and you know, it's just one guy with a microphone. There's no script in front of him. The better guys still improvise a whole lot, but you know, it's the sort of thing where some of the other guys are more tempted to skip to the script so as not to, you know, raise any eyebrows.
And if you go too far from what they're looking for, you might not get the good lines or get to win next time, I imagine.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, there are a lot of ways that you can anger your boss, and you know, ruining a live show is probably one of the worst ones.
Well, let's hear another improviser, Randy Savage, Macho Man Randy Savage.
Oh, wow, Mr. Sarcasm. Yeah, I don't care if you got 23 wrestlers around the outside, and it doesn't even matter, no, because I am ready, and I will not let this opportunity slip through my fingers. Cup of coffee, man, yeah. Man! Wow, man, freaked out!
That's performance art, man. Talk about Randy Savage a little.
That's one of my favorite promos of all time. If you can go on YouTube and just like search for Randy Savage interviews, and each one is just more hypnotic than the last. He was one of the true greats, probably my all-time favorite wrestler. And one of the things I get into, there's a chapter about him in the book. One of the things I get into is that he kind of turned himself into the Macho Man off camera. He adopted the voice, so he just spoke like that all the time.
Weird.
And he became sort of just as conspiracy-minded and possessive of Miss Elizabeth and just as much of an oddball in real life as he was on, you know, on screen and in the ring. Which is sort of, you know, sort of tragic, but he was, when he was on, he was one of the best ever.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Joseph with us in Beaver Dam. Joseph, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up?
I was wondering what the kind of, I guess I'd call it the recruiting process was for the professional wrestling promoters or the big companies, like how they go about finding new wrestlers.
Oh yeah, where do these guys come from, David?
Well, it's changed a lot over time. I mean, there was a period, from sort of the 50s into the 90s where there were a lot of guys who wanted to be wrestlers, but there were still a bunch of guys that were, you know, athletes that had failed at other things. Or, you know, there was a long time until pretty recently, if you were a football player and you blew out your knee, your football days were done, but maybe you could still be a wrestler, you know, that sort of thing. Now, the majority of guys who are wrestling are guys that grew up watching wrestling and really want it, and that's all they want to do. They'll tell you a lot of different ways to get in, but for the most part, you have to find a small wrestling school somewhere around to learn the basics. You got to work out so, you know, you look like a guy WWE may want to hire. And then eventually you get called up to WWE, or their developmental system. But right now, recently, they've expanded their developmental system really dramatically. It's down in Florida, and they have 100 or more people training at any given time. They have a giant new facility with like 7 rings in it, and they're kind of trying to build their own minor league system from the ground up. So that's, I guess, the short version. You got to get your introductory knowledge somewhere, and then just like anything else in life, you got to be willing to take the beating for free for a while and hope something works out for you.
Well, let's talk on the serious side about the beatings that these wrestlers take over the years. What kind of physical toll do we see on them?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty serious toll. I started writing about wrestling because there was a period in the, you know, late 90s through 2000s where a lot of the idols that I had growing up were dying really early. You know, I mean, there were guys like Ravishing Rick Rude and Flying Brian Pillman the list goes on and on. So I started writing I write kind of tributes to them. And that eventually led into, you know, a deeper field of research into the history of wrestling and it became this book. But thankfully the industry has gotten better. They're, you know, taking concussions more seriously as the NFL is and taking the general well-being of their athletes more seriously. There was a long period in the 80s and 90s where life on the road as a wrestler, you know, these guys were living like rock stars, except they were just like, it was like rock stars who, you know, played a game of football on the offensive line every single night of the week. So there was a lot of drug use, there was a lot of drinking, and there was an ungodly amount of painkillers and steroids. And that all adds up to, bad news for your heart. But like I said, it seemed to be in a much better place now. And it's certainly true that the WWE is taking those sort of health issues much more seriously.
And let's talk about the future of professional wrestling. It seems like it's gone through heydays and then gotten a little less popular and come back. Now there's the competition with all the mixed martial arts out there, and that's capturing a lot of the pay-per-view, it seems like. Is it on the upswing, professional wrestling, or facing tough times?
It's been pretty steady for a while. I mean, they have a core constituency that doesn't seem to be going anywhere. But there's just that there's, you know, an extra couple of percentage points that they keep trying to reclaim. You know, WWE is also kind of in the midst of a long-term process to attract more really young viewers, so that they sort of replenish the ranks of fans for the next generation. But, you know, overall, the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows of wrestling popularity seem to have less to do with the planning of the major wrestling companies and more to do with either the surprise, pop culture relativity, I mean, the pop culture significance of a singular star or just some other external influence, like, you know, a new television platform like I was talking about before. There's some indication that, you know, with the rise of people watching on Netflix and Hulu and stuff like that, the WWF properties are more valuable than they've ever been, and that might be the next, you know, the next big wave of wrestling popularity.
All right, just a few seconds left. Your favorite wrestling to movie star crossover?
Wow, my favorite wrestler who became a movie star,
or was in a movie star otherwise?
Man, that's really tough. I mean, my favorite—it's really hard for me to say my favorite wrestling movie would be anything but No Holds Barred, because it's just such a beautiful mess. But you know, I was talking to somebody just the other day about The Rock and how we almost didn't know how good we had it when he was a wrestler, because nobody would have thought. Everybody thought that Hulk Hogan was the ceiling for wrestlers in Hollywood. It turned out that The Rock is
given
the light of that.
David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
David Shoemaker is the author of The Squared Circle. I pick Rowdy Roddy Piper in They Live by John Carpenter.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at the achievement gap in Wisconsin schools. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Hidden Wisconsin. We go behind the scenes with one man who teaches fathers to be better parents.
First, though, Wisconsin had a poor showing nationally today as test results for 4th and 8th graders around the country were released in what's referred to as the nation's report card.
Although there were some gains overall, Wisconsin posted the largest achievement gap between black and white students of any state in the country for both 4th and 8th graders in math and reading. That's all according to test results from the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
Here with us to talk about the results is Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
So the headline from these new test results is Wisconsin's achievement gap, what the worst. Can you recap those scores for us?
Yeah, the test scores that came out, and everyone always has to be careful when the NAEP scores are released, because it's even an interesting thing. Google test results NAEP, and you will get such a myriad of interpretations of the scores that it's best to look at NAEP from a broader view. This particular year, with the results, Wisconsin does indeed have among the top five, or maybe we should say bottom five, results when it comes to the achievement gaps between white students and then students of color. So it's not only among African-American students, it's among the whole group. For example, only 9% of African-American students in eighth grade reading were judged proficient. We had 55% of African-American students have their reading skills in eighth grade rated below basic. So that's the largest of any state in the union. And, you know, you can't sugarcoat that result. That is generally not. Wisconsin doesn't generally think of ourselves at the bottom looking up at other states. And there are similar types of issues among fourth grade reading, eighth grade math, and fourth grade math. So it's a significant issue.
So, and adding to that, among eighth graders, black students in Wisconsin scored the lowest on reading in the entire country, as I read it, followed by Mississippi and Alabama. That seems like quite a badge of shame. What does a score like that tell us about education in Wisconsin?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that one of the things that the NAEP is it does a representative sample. So it tells you a lot of information about the state. It doesn't tell you any information about a particular school district. So while there might be some people that are tempted to lay this on the doorstep of MPS in Milwaukee or any other district, it does not provide those pieces of information. So you have to do this pullback and be able to then look at other districts. So first, let's look at this as a statewide issue, not a district issue. However, what it tells you is that these students are not scoring well, A, compared to students across the nation of similar ethnic and racial background. And B, it tells you that a lot of students in Wisconsin that are white and Anglo are doing well. So this is an interesting sort of double-edged sword, two sides of the same coin, et cetera, idea. So it's one of these good news, bad news things, but it's so extreme on the poor performance of non-white students statewide that this is clearly something that has to get the attention of the state, and any one particular district is either, you know, it's incorrect to lay this at any one particular district.
Well, and given that the national conversation lately in education has been focused on closing the achievement gap, even though there have been gains overall among broad categories of students, we have to look at this achievement gap and where Wisconsin's showing up. How does a failure like this read nationally if you're looking at it from that level?
Well, and that is interesting because we do know that there are things that schools can do that address increasing academic achievement for students. For example, we know that there are very effective reading programs like the Reading Recovery Program. Anybody out there listening that knows anything about reading knows that that's the gold standard for effective reading remediation programs. It's phenomenal. It's very expensive. So districts have tried to use variations of that program. However, one of the things to keep in mind is if you are increasing the academic performance of students that are already doing well will statistically increase their performance even faster, and students that are not doing well will improve, but they will improve at a slower pace. So what that means is that overall improvement increases, it just increases faster for those students positioned socially, economically, culturally, to be able to excel at school, and it increases slower for students that are not as positioned to be able to take advantage of increased school performance. So you can't just say it's one size fits all, and that's the big issue here. It's not one size fits all. So we've been testing like crazy for a decade and a half, maybe two decades. Maybe it's time to rethink how we approach some of these needs. Maybe it's time to have a more distribution of research and innovation and involve classroom teachers in this conversation and not just impose another new program of the day on classes. So, you know, it's a complex issue, but it's a real problem because those students deal with that every single day. And this is across the nation, of course, too, not just in Wisconsin.
Well, what you're talking about, you know, sounds like something that would be a perfect thing to try, individualizing the education plans for each student. But everyone knows that in schools, they're strapped for time, they're strapped for resources, they're strapped for person power. How could something like that actually be implemented?
And I think you raise a really, really valuable point. Education in Wisconsin, at least on the K-12 level, has taken some significant hits in the last 2 years. And this is not an overall area that has extremely high amounts of morale. Last couple of years, you've had the teachers that have been at least partially blamed, I think, misdirectingly, for the deficit in Wisconsin. So you've had the decertification of unions. You've had districts now that are helping to distribute money to voucher schools. And then you have the state agency that's overseeing part of this distribution of money to private schools. So the trend that this might portend, one would look at this and say, boy, where's the motivation and the energy, the funding, and the will to have these students in the public schools be able to get the programs that they need? This is a great big issue because research has shown whether it's choice or voucher or whatever the schools, that overall the students that take advantage of those generally are already in a position to do well in school. And so Wisconsin has some policy decisions to look at that will address the needs of these underrepresented groups.
So are you saying with vouchers, you're saying maybe we don't have the data points yet to decide whether or not this is something that could help?
Well, I think the overall evidence shows that with voucher schools, well, vouchers, of course, are still very, very new in Wisconsin, and the measures from those schools even have yet to be determined. But vouchers came into place for a political reason, which is fine. That's politics. Hey, welcome to Wisconsin. But there is no evidence to show that voucher schools are the way to be able to go to address the achievement gap. Yet, as a state, we're moving towards increased attention and funding to voucher schools. So the point is that there needs to be a broader policy discussion about how do we get all of these groups raised, or are we going to target the underperforming groups only? And it's very difficult to do everything that you need to have done. And Wisconsin has been paid much more attention lately to teachers and teacher pay and districts and district funding policies, and now the establishment of voucher schools and private schools. And this has not received attention in the last 2 years. I have yet to hear somebody stand up and really rail on this issue. So it hasn't received the attention, and it needs to.
Now, in our last 30 seconds or so, let's say your state superintendent, Tony Evers, your governor, Scott Walker, you see these scores. What are you thinking, and what do you want to do tomorrow?
Well, that's very true. Of course, one of the other sides to this is these underrepresented groups also rarely receive political attention. So it is going to have to take more of a statesman's approach. And, of course, there is no simple answer. And what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to look at what are effective programs. They're going to have to develop the time and the training for the teachers to develop these and encourage innovation and continue to take looks at this, because, you know, we do need to realize that what we've been doing probably isn't serving this population very well, and we need to look at new methods.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Glad to be here. Thank you.
That was Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College.
Now we'll check the headlines, then we'll be back with our Hidden Wisconsin series. Today we look at the job of fatherhood. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's time now for our Hidden Wisconsin segment, where we find out about the jobs people are doing behind the scenes.
Today, we talk to a Milwaukee man who helps other men to be better fathers. Delvin Crawford is with us. He's a fatherhood specialist at Next Door, an early education center in Milwaukee. Delvin, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Well, first, what in your life and your personal experience made you want to help other men to be better fathers?
Well, I think it was a series of personal experiences that happened that led me up to it. However, I don't think that, you know, it was one in particular, but I believe what ultimately led me up to it is when I came home one morning when I was living with my mother while I was still in college, and she found me in the car intoxicated. She took a look at me and said some words that I believe changed my life. She said, "You remind me of just like your daddy," and then she walked away crying. Those words hit me like a ton of bricks. To know that I was associated with the pain that she once experienced while married to my dad devastated me. See, I remembered the verbal and physical abuse, how I wouldn't see my dad for 1 or 2 weeks at a time, and every time we would see him, he would either be intoxicated and disorderly. I remember leaving the house like at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning when I was about 10 years old, with bags full of clothes, knocking on relatives' doors, just trying to find a place to sleep that night. So you could imagine the effect that she had on me when she said those words. I mean, I started going to church, I got married, made a vow to sacrifice my life for the benefit of my wife and children, and I lived this way for years. And the thing was that after I did that, my son, he started going to Next Door, you know, attending it, and I wanted to be involved in his development. So I visited his class. I got on the parent policy board, did poetry workshops, participated in a number of events, you know, that they had at the agency. And one day when I actually dropped him off at school, one of the directors actually came to me and said, did you apply for the fatherhood specialist position? Not knowing that it was such a position, I applied for it, got hired, and now I'm here today with the honor of being on the Wisconsin radio show.
All right. Well, tell us about the fathers who come through the door there to check out the fatherhood programs, just like you did. What kind of situations are they facing?
Some of the barriers that they face deals with employment, deals with education. There's a lot of fathers that we work with that may have been incarcerated. You know, they came from situations where they came from dysfunctional families and dysfunctional homes. So there's just a lot of different things as far as what happened in their childhood, you know, dealing with childhood trauma, seeing some of the things that actually goes on within their community and actually has shaped their perceptions, the way that they look at life. And what happens is that they end up growing up, you know, actually being probably in that stage of boyhood, never transitioning fully into manhood. So those are some of the things that we deal with. That's why we provide so many different trainings, so many different classes, to just to try to get them to see things in a way they probably didn't see it before.
And how does it work when they're working with you, a fatherhood specialist there? Are you up in front of a class or talking to them one-to-one? How does that work?
Well, it happens in various ways. We actually have a class format where we have fathers actually enroll into the classes, and it's like a four-week course, and it's Monday and Wednesday or Tuesday and Thursday, and they come for 25 sessions for 4 weeks, and it's like two-hour intervals. And what they do is that when they come, you know, we have food that's provided, you know, if they didn't have transportation, maybe we might provide bus tickets, but it's like a classroom setting. But then we have other places where we might have just like man-to-man groups, and it can be topic-driven. And, you know, when they come in, maybe we might have, you know, some food that's available. You know, people can come in and actually talk about some of the things that they may be going through at that present time, and then we can address those things accordingly.
Do you get the sense that the guys you're working with want to be better dads? They just maybe don't know where to start?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, when I talk to the fathers that, you know, that we come in contact with, they always, you know, they have this passion to become a better dad, but they don't know where to start, you know. And a lot of times what happens is that you might place yourself in certain situations and, you know, different things may have happened in your life to put you in certain things that, you know, say, for instance, if you ended up in jail, or say, for instance, if you end up having something happen with your license because of drunk driving, and, you know, different things like that that you learn in boyhood, and you made all of these different choices, and, you know, some of the things that were negative, and what happens is that you realize, you have an epiphany, like, wow, you know, I can't believe that I did that. Well, where do I start, you know, because I haven't been taught the proper way to go. So I'm just trying to find out what is the best way for me to live my life. So they come to our fatherhood class. They are enthusiastic. They want to learn more. And the thing is that we also give them the opportunity to express their views, where their perceptions may have come from. And we never look down on them. We want to, you know, everything that they say is valued because we understand that it came from a certain place and we all can learn from one another.
So it's not a tough love thing, but you try to give helpful advice. What kind of advice, like if somebody comes in and says, I don't know where to start, what do you tell them?
Well, I mean, the first thing that we want to do is that, you know, as soon as the guys come in and they don't know where to start, I say we cannot let our past dictate the outcome of our future, for number one. And one thing that I also try to share is that in boyhood, we learn so many negative messages on how to manipulate and deceive people to get what we want, to be a womanizer, and other messages that we may have learned, you know, on what it means to be a man. But a lot of times what we do is that we talk about the phases of fatherhood, from, you know, boyhood to manhood to husbandhood and to fatherhood. And a lot of instances we skip from boyhood to fatherhood and try to become a father, you know, fathering a child, when we don't really know what it means to be a man. So the analogy that I try to use for our fathers is that the race is not given to the swift nor the strong, but the one that endures to the end. You know, things may have started off rocky for you as a father, but it doesn't have to end that way. So as long as you don't give up, you'll always place yourself in a position to win the fight.
In doing this job, do you see a lot of success stories or people who are making really positive strides?
Oh, yes, I all the time, you know, because we have certain people that may have come in and they felt like they couldn't see that light at the end of the tunnel. And when they come in and they see all the other fathers that are involved in our classes and they have their short-term goals, they have their long-term goals, and you have to understand, you know, I even came from a place that they may have came from. You know, I didn't have my father in my life for until I was like 16, 17 years old. And he was an alcoholic. It was certain things that he did. But he actually straightened up his act, and he came into my life, and it showed me that it was never too late to be a father. So the thing is that they're able to relate, you know, to our stories, relate to the things that we have been through, and they know that if it can be done for us, it can be done for them as well.
All right. Before we go, just 30 seconds or so, can you share a couple of words of wisdom for any parent out there listening?
For any parent that's listening, you know, one of the things that I would like to, you know, just share is that no matter where you came from, no matter where you've been, no matter, you know, what may have happened in your life, you know, things can definitely turn around if you position yourself to, you know, just place yourself in a position where things can change. You know, no matter, you know, if you had some shortcomings in your life, you know, anything dealing with childhood trauma, anything dealing with, you know, some of the forks in the road that may have happened, you know, I really believe that you can be the pioneer of your situation. Whatever your father may have done or your mother have done, regardless of who you may not have had in your life, you have to know when you know better, then you have an opportunity to do better.
All right.
And then you can go ahead and do whatever it is that you need to do to be not only an individual as far as bettering yourself, but also, you know, be there.
All right, Delvin, thanks a lot. We're out of time. That's Delvin Crawford, fatherhood specialist at Next Door, an early education center in Milwaukee.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, some advice on baking bread. This is Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a tour of the White House and find out what it's like to live and work there. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.